On this episode of Skeptico.
High magic, which you found to be kind of masculine-oriented, hierarchically dominant. You felt a calling to move more towards a Wicca and this goddess concept.
Being close to nature was very important to me, and that Wicca was a way of working that enabled that to take place. So, you know, being able to have rational conversations with animals, plants, was also quite important to me. Just because you're psychic, it doesn't mean that you're safe. So I think you need to know practices that keep you safe while you're exploring in the other reality. Otherwise, you know, quite dire things can happen. Evil definitely exists. And to say that it doesn't is just ludicrous, naive. I guess if you're a master, a spiritual master, you can transcend all of the stuff that goes on in the physical world. But if someone has a spirit attachment and they're ill because of it, why wouldn't you want to help them?
If a Christian comes to me and says, hey, you know what? It's all about love. It's all about selfless service. I get that. What they're saying speaks to my heart versus if I speak to someone and they practice magic and the first thing they want to tell me is about Aleister Crowley and do what thou wilt. I don't get it.
You know, people who see Jesus, in inverted commas, standing at the end of the tunnel, you know, in light, are actually experiencing an encounter with their own soul, not Jesus, because Jesus, in my view, doesn't actually exist.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and coming up on this episode, I have an interesting interview with Dr. Jane Kent, who is bringing shamanistic practices to her therapy and counseling work. It's an interesting perspective, and I think as the interview goes on, it gets more and more interesting because the veneer of our common ground is stripped away, and we get at some of the deeper issues. And one of the things that we get into that I think is very interesting and relevant to our show, Skeptico, is how we deal with good, evil, how we deal with the near-death experience science that suggests this goodness and light and love and God kind of thing, and how that fits with other people who see the extended realms differently, as Dr. Kent does. You'll hear her kind of quite matter-of-factly say she just doesn't believe in anything like Christ consciousness and just can't wrap her arms around that, which I find very, very interesting indeed. And while I'm at it, I wanted to mention that, you know, the episode we published recently with near-death experience researcher Dr. Jeff Long really took off on the forum in some interesting ways. There were over 300 comments on the forum, and if you haven't checked those out, you might want to. It's been an interesting dialogue, but a lot of the dialogue centered around some of these same issues that we get into here, which is, you know, what are we really talking about when Dr. Long talks about God and love, and it stirs up a lot of religious sentiments that people have, usually negative religious sentiments, and it challenges a lot of us in a lot of ways. And hey, I think that's interesting. That's the kind of dialogue that I want to have on this show, and that's what made this interview with Jane so interesting. So before I jump into the interview, once again, I really love the kind of participation that we got in the forum the last couple times. It's been great to kind of hash these ideas out after the show. We get so much out of it, as well as, you know, some of you who've called in on the new call-in line on Skeptico, and that's so cool to get those voice messages. And I've had even more emails, some really, really nice emails telling me what the show has meant for you and how maybe it's furthered your exploration of all these topics. So
I just wanted to pass along a big thank you. You know, those always are so great. You know, when you sit here in front of the mic and you're just not sure if anyone's really connecting on all these topics, and then to hear that someone's listened for a year or two and really has connected with you in a way is really kind of a cool feeling. It is what podcasting is all about. So with that mushy stuff out of the way, let's move on to this interview with Dr. Jane Kent, which really had some interesting twists and turns in it. I'll be interested to see what you think. Today, we welcome Dr. Jane Kent to Skeptico. Jane is a therapist with a postgraduate degree in counseling and psychotherapy and a doctorate in social ecology from the University of West Sydney in Australia. And she has a new book out titled The Goddess and the Shaman, which really shatters that nice-sounding, academically sanitized bio that I just read for you, because as you'll hear, her book documents her own dynamic tension, to use her words, with the Western paradigms of health and healing and her unexpected encounters with extended consciousness realms, high magic, Wicca, and shamanism. And in particular, how she's managed to meld all that into what she calls the fragility of therapy. It's quite a journey and quite an interesting book. Jane, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, you know, I was lucky enough to see some early chapters of this book because your partner, Michael Patterson, has been in contact with me. We have a nice email exchange going on back and forth, and he's actually written a couple of excellent posts for Skeptico. So it was really neat to see this, and I was really excited about it. And then now to see the book come out as a finished product, I'm sure you're quite excited, are you?
I am excited about it, yes. I didn't send it to many publishers. In fact, I only sent it to one publisher, and I was expecting it to be knocked back, but they accepted it, so I was quite surprised about that and grateful.
And Llewellyn has published it, right?
Yes, Llewellyn, yeah. Alicia Gallo was my editor.
Ah, that's awesome. And, I mean, that's really kind of top of the heap when it comes to at least the magic and esoterica world, so that's awesome, right?
Yeah, it was.
So we are going to talk probably indirectly about the book. The book is really something people should check out, and I hope you do, The Goddess and the Shaman. But what we really want to do is get to know you, and because another thing that – I guess one thing that people push back on me is they always say, you know, you have these materialistic nitwits on, and you love to push them with hard questions and really grill them, but then when you get – other people on that are more of your bent, you kind of give them all these softball questions. So I am not going to do that with you, Jane.
Oh, good. I'm getting the hardball treatment.
Oh, no, we'll see. I can't throw anything too hard at you, because I think the body of your work and what you do is really something extraordinary. Because to be a people helper and to come at things from this kind of traditional, a blend of this traditional Western perspective, but also with this mind towards all this other stuff that seems to be happening, and be willing to bring that to the table in some way or another is a hard task. So you're to be commended for even trying to do it.
Thank you.
So where to start? I don't know. You know, this idea of a dynamic tension between traditional Western paradigms and all the magical shamanistic stuff you've ventured into seems to be a reoccurring theme, not only in the book, but in your life. When did that start? Do you remember your first non-ordinary experience?
Yes. When I was a small child, really, about 8 or 9, my grandfather had just died. My maternal grandfather had just died. And I saw him. He walked over to me because everybody in the house was really crying and sobbing and, you know, crying hysterically. And he walked over to me and he said, "Don't worry, sweetheart, I'm okay," and patted me on the head. So that was my first encounter with the other reality, and also that the idea that consciousness extends beyond physical life. So that was quite a profound experience for a small child. And I didn't know how to relate to it or how to describe it to anyone. I just kind of tucked it away in the back of my mind, thinking that at the time I'll bring that out sometime when I'm bigger and know more and try to work out what it really means. So that was my first experience with the other reality.
But it sounds like from reading the book that that other reality weaved its way back into your life, and it also sounded like, and this is totally understandable, that you were battling with kind of pushing it away and pursuing – you're obviously very bright, so you're pursuing an academic career and academically oriented kind of things, and you probably were wise enough to see, hey, you know, that's not really going to fit over here, so let's just kind of push that back. How did that work, that having, living in those two worlds and trying to balance them?
It was difficult because, you know – our education system is profoundly materialistic, and you know, science is very materialistic. So, you know, living in this world and knowing, having knowledge of another world was a bit of a juggling act. I tended to just really keep quiet about it and not discuss it with anybody.
And then one of the things, I guess you really, it sounds like you really found a home at the University of Western Sydney, huh? That was a more welcoming place, a little enclave where you could satisfy both those needs. Is that probably true?
To a point, yes. Social ecology was a very open-minded kind of discipline, and I was very lucky to have a thesis supervisor who was open-minded and supportive. So that really helped. I think that's changed today. I think the university's striving to become more mainstream and more respectable. I fear that's the case. But at the time, I was very lucky to be enrolled in a faculty that had an open-minded approach to discussing reality, and a supervisor who did really support me and encourage me.
But it sounds like you were still damping things down quite a bit in order to fit through, which is great. And also, I think that that's what your therapeutic work is all about. From what I hear, it's this layering of kind of traditional techniques in with some of these other realizations. And, you know, I thought we might do, because we're talking around what you do, and maybe it's best to give people just a real jump in the deep end of the pool kind of taste of what it's all about. Here's a chapter that you sent me very early on. Actually, Mike forwarded it to me, and I think it's a fantastic story. It's chapter 12 from your book about Zach and Josephine. Do you remember that story? So this, folks, is a case where Dr. Kent actually relates these therapeutic, a synopsis of these therapeutic sessions she's had that venture into some of these other realms, and how that can be brought to bear in therapy, and how it can help people better their lives in ways that we just really can't imagine how a traditional Western approach could do it. So best just to dive in and tell folks about Josephine and Zach.
It's a terribly tragic story, but Josephine came to see me because she was having outbursts of rage and also panic attacks. And her partner found it extremely difficult to live with all of this. So he paid for her to come and have some therapeutic treatment. She came back to the far north coast of New South Wales. She'd been living in Western Australia. Came back to the far north coast of New South Wales to find a therapist, and eventually she found me. And it just struck me when she came for her one of the early sessions, I just noticed that she was a very beautiful girl, but dressed in a very plain, masculine way, like wearing delivery man outfit, shorts and a shirt. And I just thought that it was a bit of a strange dichotomy there. So I decided to work with that. And eventually she told me that she'd had a brother who was around her age who'd suicided in very tragic circumstances. He was 12 when he – oh, no, he was 11 when he actually suicided. And it was because he was, had been caught stealing at school, and his parents were told that they ought to chastise him severely for this. Anyway, they did that, and the next few minutes, he walked into the parents' wardrobe and took out his father's gun and killed himself in the wardrobe. Now,
just your as a parent, just your absolute worst nightmare. I think that's why the story was just absolutely chilling to me, because we all struggle with, you know, where to draw the line and disciplining. Yeah. And then we have these institutions that come and say, gee, you know, you're really not doing your parenting the way you could. And it was like just a little window into what really sometimes goes on in the minds of young people. But please go ahead and finish the story and what this did to this family.
Oh, well, it was completely devastating. Everybody was traumatized in profound shock, and Josephine was hospitalized after this event, and for quite a few weeks she was teetering on the verge of death herself. And anyway, she did recover. She came to see me, and as she was talking to me, I had a vision.
And now she came to see you, what, 10, 15 years later,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she was in her 20s when she came to see me. Say 10 years later. I'd have to check the case notes to tell you exactly, because I haven't got it in front of me. But she, as she was talking to me, I had a vision behind her of a young boy standing in a desolate field all covered with weeds. And so I asked her about this, and she told me that her younger brother had suicided in that way. And I began to think that the panic attacks she was suffering and the outburst of rage might be connected to him somehow. And as we explored it, I became more and more convinced about it. And what had happened after the suicide, the whole family had just closed down and never talked about Zach again. And it was like he hadn't even really existed. And so she told me that, actually I told her it'd be a good idea to go out to the grave and see what was happening. So she had to drive out of the country town we were working in, about 20 kilometres outside the town. They lived on a multiple occupancy community, and the grave was there on the community, and it was just totally neglected, covered with weeds and no headstone or anything. So she decided that they needed to do something about that. The family needed to start talking about it and doing something about it. And as all that unfolded, it became clearer and clearer that what was happening in Josephine's life was Zach trying to communicate what he needed from her. And that was all about honouring him and setting up a proper grave site. And when all that happened, when the father and mother became involved in it, they put a big headstone out there with his name on it and the date of his death, and they kept it simple. All of a sudden, all of her symptoms just disappeared. The panic attacks stopped, the outbursts of rage and other physical symptoms that she'd been suffering just all disappeared. So, you know, I can't give you photographic proof or evidence that this actually happened, but it was quite convincing circumstantial evidence that Zach had been attached to her in spirit form and trying to get her attention and trying to communicate what he needed in order to move on into the other reality rather than being earthbound, so to speak.
Right. Although, you know, you've kind of tied it up into a nice History Channel spooky story there, but I like the way you treat it in the book, because you actually leave open some really interesting twists at the end, and that kind of the whimsical way that she says, oh, you know, and I made a vow to light a candle every year and remember Zach, but you know what? I don't even do it anymore. I don't even think about it. And I thought, you know, what does this say? Because in a way, it can kind of roll back the whole story into, you know, what is Zach's real needs on the other side? And why would we even suspect that someone on the other side would have a need other than, or was the need really to give this to his sister as a way of kind of relieving some of the things that she had experienced and other members of her family? And so let's kind of tackle that one first. And there's a big follow-up question I have there as well. But what do you think about that?
I think he was probably too young to be thinking that way, because he was stuck at the age of 11, and I think he just felt totally abandoned by his family and needed their recognition. That's my view anyway, but there could have been other elements in all of it. He could have been trying to help his sister to move on. I can't say definitively whether that was the case or not. But, you know, an 11-year-old suiciding is a pretty horrific thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think, yeah, the last thing he remembered of his parents while he was consciously in the body was being chastised and told how bad he was. And I think that he needed to hear that he was actually a good person, worthy of respect, and that he had a contact with his sister. They had a real contact in life, in the body, and I think that he went to her because he thought she would be the most open to helping him and hearing what needed to be done.
And how would you characterize or categorize this type of work, Jane, that you did? Is this shamanism? Is it magic? Is, you know, if we had to put a label on it, sounds to me just like after death communication. You know, I've talked to a bunch of mediums and bunch of mediums and part of a medium experiment that I did with medium researchers. And that's what these people do all day long. Is it just pure mediumistic after death communication, or is there some shamanistic aspect to it? I'm sorry, or am I kind of splitting hairs there, and even the definitional kind of thing is it doesn't matter?
Well, I think shamanism is just a method of altering consciousness and being able to work, you know, successfully on the other level, the subtle level of reality. I don't think there's anything more mysterious about it than that. You know, some people have to do a ritual in order to gain that level of consciousness. And in tribal societies, that's the common way of doing it, through suspending the intellectualizing part of the mind and going straight to the part of the mind that can communicate telepathically with the subtle reality. So that might be drumming or dancing or deep meditation or whatever. But some people in the West in particular can just kind of click over and work from that level in a more natural way. Well, I don't know if I say more natural way, but an easier way than spending a few hours drumming in order to change consciousness, if you know what I mean.
So you're saying it's really kind of all about the net effect of reaching those extended consciousness realms and the kind of words that we attach to it in terms of mediumistic communication versus shamanism versus...
Yeah, well, it's not versus anything, really. It's all the same thing, in my view. It's being able to work in the subtle reality in whatever way. A lot of people would disagree with that because they see shamanism as something that involves ceremonial and, you know, taking peyote or whatever in order to change consciousness. But, you know, I don't think it's always necessary to do that. And maybe a more modern way is just being able to, well, you know, my experience is being conscious on two levels at the same time. In Josephine's case, I was working with her in the physical world, but also conscious of another consciousness behind her in the subtle world. And I thought that was important. I sort of indicated that this person was attached to her in spirit form. And that was probably the cause of the panic attacks, heart palpitations and other things that she was suffering, outbursts of rage like we've already talked about. So,
you know, I guess one of the things that I get hung up on when I try and approach this extended consciousness stuff from a somewhat scientific standpoint, and I realize right off the bat that that's a hopeless proposition, because once we step out of the materialistic kind of drive to measure and control, and once we give that up, we can't really reintroduce it. But we all try and do that because we like the comfort of our little consensus reality, scientific, hold the ruler up, how does this compare with that? But the problem I always run into is we wind up presupposing so many things about these other realms. I mean, I can tell you, people that I've directly spoken with and worked with who have have entered those extended consciousness realms for the purpose of doing therapeutic work with a totally and have a total different perspective, like a total Christian overlay, and say, you know, this is really the work of Jesus. And I went in, and I worked with this one woman, and she came back and proved to me amazing results that she was able to achieve and actually documented in a little experiment that we did. And yet that was her overlay. And then, you know, you'll find people that'll have another overlay that is an alien or UFO overlay. And yet, again, I've spoken to Mary Rodwell there in Australia, and she does spiritual work with folks in a lot of cases. And again, it's with an other's alien overlay. And I think this is one of the things that is challenging to me and to a lot of people, is that how much do we really know, and how much can we pretend that we know about these extended consciousness realms?
Well, you know, people work in different ways. I've got no problem with that. But, you know, I work in my own particular way, and it's something that's evolved over time, and it doesn't have any religious connotations or, you know, alien connotations. I think if you're doing something, I take a pragmatic view of it. If it's working, why would you not do it? You know, if it's actually helping people to improve their health or whatever, why wouldn't you do it? I don't see a problem with that. Yeah, I guess it's a case of the proof is in the pudding. So if something's working and the person's getting better, who cares why it's happening?
Well, on another level, we do care, right? Because when we enter into these different practices, we, one, want to do practices that are safe and do and efficacious from a therapeutic standpoint. But we also want to do practices that are, I don't know, that have meaning and, to use your terms, have the highest chance of being successful. And there's also certain concerns that I think you point out in the book of, you know, choosing your practices and choosing what those practices are going to do to you. So we do care, right? I mean, whether you choose, you make the point in the book about having explored magic and kind of making a move away from high magic, which you found to be kind of masculine oriented, hierarchically dominant. And then you felt a calling to move more towards a Wicca and this goddess concept. So, I mean, there would be a place where you care, right? I mean, you care about one or another. You have a preference. You have an orientation that presupposes a lot about these extended consciousness realms, right?
Well, I just found that being close to nature was very important to me, and that Wicca was a way of working that enabled that to take place. So, you know, being able to have rational conversations with animals, plants, was also quite important to me. So high magic is a very... It's kind of an indoors pursuit, if you know what I mean, in my view. Other people might not agree with that. But the nature basis of the goddess religion and Wicca is very close to, say, American Indian way of looking at the world, or, you know, American Indian tribes, tribal spirituality. That's a bit of a blanket term, but, and I realize that different tribes have different kinds of approaches to the other world. But being respectful of nature, I think, is a really important part of all of that. That's what appeals to me about the whole Wiccan pathway. We can learn a lot from nature, learn a lot from being in nature. And, yeah, so having said that, I think it's very important to have some knowledge, and not just because you're psychic, it doesn't mean that you're safe. So I think you need to know practices that keep you safe while you're exploring in the other reality. Otherwise, you know, quite dire things can happen.
See, and those are the kind of little phrases, I think, that really send people for a loop, because, again, it presupposes a deeper knowledge of these realms that seem to be, for most of us, outside of our you know, grasp of what's going on. It's like, okay, you've entered this other realm, and you have this knowledge, and there's some certain warning signs. I mean, is that real, I guess, is the question that a lot of us have.
Well, what you're asking me, I think, is can anybody do this, or should everybody be able to do this? I think it depends on the level of sophistication that you have in understanding the world. So it's basically a philosophical problem, as I see it. It's a problem that is around the whole idea of what is reality. So I think, in order to work in that way, you have to have certain understandings. And one of the understandings is that we are not physical bodies at our core. We're spiritual beings in physical form. So having understanding of that is very important. It enables you to at least speculate about other levels of reality being real. So I think that's quite important. And also it depends on what level and what state the chakras in the energy body have developed to. If the chakras are healthy and working properly, and all major seven chakras are working properly, then you do have that ability to see and work in the other realms. If they're not, well, you just don't have that ability. In my view, that's what we're here to do in the physical world. We're learning to refine ourselves spiritually. And that might take lifetimes. It might not happen in a current lifetime. It might take many more lifetimes in order to refine our understanding, to get to that level, to be able to work in that way.
Let me approach this same topic, if I can, from a couple of different points. In one of the chapters in your book, you talk about this turning point that you experienced and the ontological shock, you say, and it has to do with this experience, this physical experience you had that led to your first out-of-body experience. And one of the things that struck me about the way that you tell that story is how surprising it was to you, because I was kind of thinking that at this point you would have been more, I don't know, accepting or further along in kind of integrating that, but you weren't. You were kind of running to the doctor and to the neurologist and saying, what's going on here, you know? So tell about that story, and then I want to talk about Robert Monroe, which is kind of a point, the data point out there that you reached through his book and said, aha, this is at least a description of what another person has experienced that relates to this. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yes. Where do you want me to tell the whole story or just encapsulate
the whole story?
Okay. I'd always had an ability to lie down and rest and allow my consciousness to drift into a kind of free-floating pattern. And I was doing this one day, and this kind of funny bright vibration started in my body, particularly my head, around my jaw. My whole body was internally vibrating, shaking, but it didn't appear on the external body at all. Like, I couldn't see my hands shaking. It was internal. And it happened many times, like over a period of weeks, it kept recurring. I thought, oh God, this is over now, thank God. I'm probably epileptic. But it kept occurring. So in the book, I say I spoke to my brother about it, and he told me he was reading a book called Out of the Body by Robert Munro, and gave it to me, and I read it, and it directly described everything that I'd been experiencing. And he said it was a pathway to getting out of your physical body. And so next time it happened, I just allowed myself to float out of the body and separated from the physical body, and could, standing on the floor beside my physical body, I could still hear and see completely normally, even though I was only attached to the body by a fragile kind of umbilical cord, if you will. And so I just realized that it's possible to separate the energy body from the physical body through that process of vibration. And in fact, you know, my subsequent researches showed that a lot of shaman practitioners do exactly that. So once I realized it wasn't such a terrifying thing, it became a lot easier to do. And I'd read in the past things about out-of-the-body experiences, but it just all seemed a bit, you know, wanky to me and not very real. But having the experience myself made it extremely real. And I believe that what happens now at death is the connection between the energy body and the physical body is severed, but consciousness isn't severed, because clearly the dead body has no consciousness, no sensory input or anything else. All of that actually exists in the energy body, which is like a subtle body. Like Don Juan in the Castaneda books talks about the energy body, and what he says about it directly is directly what I experienced. So
so why is Robert Munro so wanky, as you say? You know, I was just having this chat with your partner, Mike. No, this is exactly the conversation through email that we were having. I mean, Munro has this in crowd, bad sci-fi, wanky kind of stuff that really is just way out there. And yet that's his experience. Why is that his experience?
I don't know. I think, you know, experiences of the other reality are individual. And
if they're individual, then how, if it's individual, that's really the crux of it then, right? Because that's what we like about this materialistic consensus reality. It isn't quite so individualized, right?
Well, actually, don't you think it is? I mean, people all experience the world very differently. We don't always have a consensus view of reality, even in the physical world.
Do you think it's on par with those kind of differences, or do you think this, it's...
I think it's differences in our perception.
You think it's kind of on par when that, you know, one person can have kind of a this sci-fi overlay for whatever reason, and they can still be managing and manipulating those other realms, and you might have a kind of traditional Wicca kind of Mother Earth kind of thing, and then that's shading it in a certain way, and someone else might come at it from a kind of a Renaissance magic perspective, and they're seeing something different. But is there an underlying reality to the extended consciousness realm, or is it all things, you know? I mean, how does it work?
That's a big question. I don't know everything about this. I only know what I know. But in my experience, I've been into the subtle worlds, and what I've found is that, for example, you know, all of the great forests that exist in the physical reality that are dying actually exist in the non-physical world. And I believe that the physical world is the end point of energy from different levels of the subtle world. Like the physical world, the Aztecs describe it as the painted world. It's not real. We create it through our perceptions. And so, I mean, I did read something years ago that was quite interesting. I can't remember the source, but it was about people who've been blind and then from birth and gained their sight. They don't actually perceive the physical world as we perceive it. The article said that what they see originally is just swirls of energy and colour, and that they have to be taught in order to see the physical world in the way that most people see it. But, you know, we all know that people see colour differently, for example.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think the physical world is the least reliable of the worlds. That's why, you know, it was called the painted world, or it's actually an illusion. We create an illusion in order to live in it, in order to experience physicality, in order to work through certain things that we come to work through. I mean, one person's reason for being might be they've come to learn how to be a good mother, for example. And that's what their focus in this life is on. And there's spiritual growth in that. If you're following a spiritual design or a spiritual path, I believe that we decide on that before we come here, that we make up our minds about what we want to learn in a particular incarnation. And we struggle to learn it because we're all imperfect. We're not saints. We're not angels. We're struggling humanity trying to sort out what's reality and trying to refine ourselves. That's our goal, to refine ourselves spiritually, I believe.
That's all well enough. It's just, we've all heard that so many times, and it has so many different shades and flavors that it almost becomes, you know, worn out in some ways and kind of loses some of its meaning. And I think that's why some of the times we're trying to find some deeper understanding to that. And I know on this show, what we've often done is tried to bring science back into the equation. You know, I just interviewed a guy I have a lot of respect for, Dr. Jeff Long. He's a near-death experience researcher, and he's just written this new book, and it's about near-death experiencers' encounters with God. So this is a medical scientist, not a religious guy, not coming at it from a Christian perspective or anything like that, just someone who's collected 4,000 cases and has meticulously, with a medical survey, gone through them to try and get an understanding of what people are experiencing with regard to God. And I don't know. That's the kind of approach that, to me, it is satisfying in the sense that it gives me some grounding other than just to repeat these things that I've heard, that we all have a purpose and we all have a mission and we set it up. And I'm not saying that's not true. I'm just saying, how do we explore that? I mean, how do we explore that in a way that we can feel some degree of confidence in, beyond the confidence of the person who is delivering the message? So I can sit down with you in a therapy room, and I can get a good feeling about you, and you can tell me something about my father who's sitting over my shoulder, and then we can go from there, and we have this connection. But for a lot of us, we want something a little bit more than that. We want to know, on something more approaching a scientific level, what's going on? Because I can then leave your office and go down the street to, you know, the next person I encounter, and they can tell me everything about what you did was wrong, you know, and that there's a different reality in those extended consciousness realms.
Well, you know, science is basically a materialistic study. It doesn't really go beyond death. So, I mean, even if you're collecting information about near-death experiences, can that take you into the world beyond the physical? I don't think so.
I think it can help you navigate that in the same way that when you were talking earlier, Jane, and then you said, yeah, and there's this realm, but you have to be careful. You know, there's some good. Well, what does that mean? That suggests that there's some laws, there's some particular set of rules that one must follow.
Well, not really. I mean, if you open yourself up psychically, then you can open yourself up to spirit possession. That's what I'm talking about. And that's not a good thing for anybody. So people who want to explore in that field need to protect themselves and need to know how to do that before they venture forth, because it can be dangerous. And spirit possession can cause all kinds of illnesses, in my view, even cancer, all kinds of things. So it's not something that, you know, people should play around with.
That's a lot to say. I mean, what do we do with that? How do we understand that? I mean, that is a very specific warning that implies a certain certainty about how things work over there. Do you see what I mean? How we kind of jump back and forth between saying, well, you know, I mean, what if somebody comes out and says, well, there's no such thing really as spirit possession per se, and that your spirit can never really be possessed. There's no malevolent spirits out there. Someone could easily say that, right? They do say that.
Why would they say it? They wouldn't have any knowledge of it. It's just their speculation.
There are people who have claimed to have reach those same extended consciousness realms and said, there's nothing like that. There's no evil in that way. Now, I'm inclined.
Of course there's evil. Of course there's evil. Evil exists because good exists. We live in a dual reality, so that we wouldn't know good unless we knew evil. That's what I'm trying to say. Evil definitely exists. And to say that it doesn't is just ludicrous, naive.
Okay. I like this.
It's what they wish were reality, but it's not really reality. The physical world only exists because it has a balance between polarities. So it's a dual reality. And, you know, if we didn't know evil, how would we know good? We wouldn't be able to choose or decide in any way. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I just don't know how we really approach that. I'm inclined to agree with some of what you're saying, but you know, I'll just give you an example. I mean, if you talk to people in the non-dual community, right? The people of kind of the
Go ahead.
Because I mean, there's a lot of people that have done a tremendous amount of work. I mean, work as in meditating for thousands of hours, who in well established traditions where other, you know, you go look at the Zen tradition or you look at the Vedic tradition. I mean, there's the Tibetan tradition there, but Tibetan to get into more of a magical thing and stuff like that. But you take other ones where all that is taken out. All that stuff that you're talking about is basically stripped away. And it's nada, nada, nada. Don't look for any of that. Look beyond that. Look beyond that. And they claim an understanding of this extended reality that doesn't match up. That what they would say, I think, is that all this stuff that you're playing with is just another illusion that we need to get past, and that you're spending all your time in this kind of halfway between what really you're trying to get to and our material world there. So is that a fair and viable kind of ontological map of what's going on?
Well, I don't think so. But anyway, I'm speaking from my own experience, not their experience. And yeah, I take a more Egyptian view of reality. And in the Egyptian view, the physical world is the tomb. We are spiritual beings. We come here. We are encased in the tomb of the physical body. And the reason that happens is we're learning hard things sometimes, but it's all about learning. And, you know, I guess if you're a master, a spiritual master, you can transcend all of the stuff that goes on in the physical world. But, you know, I think if someone has a spirit attachment and they're ill because of it, why wouldn't you want to help them become free of that? So it was for some ideology. So I don't really have an ideology as such. I'm attracted to Wicca, but I'm not an ideologue about it. I really trust my own experience more than anything else. So, yeah, I know what the Buddhists say, that you transcend this world through meditation, and you probably can, but I don't know that that's very useful. So in my book I talk about that we are created from the essence of the goddess, that divinity actually exists in us at a deep level, and that we are seeking to become in contact with that sense of divinity. And we do that through our soul self. We become soul-infused beings by understanding reality and working in ways that help us come to terms with it and help refine our understanding of what spirit actually means. There's a writer called Alvin Boyd Kuhn who writes about this. He's a bit of a ranter, but there's a lot of – he's an Egyptian scholar, so I trust pretty much what he says, and that is that the Egyptians described coming from womb to tomb, and that's what happens. We're very restricted in the physical body. And I found that when I was outside my physical body, there was a sense of liberation and joy and freedom and completely different kind of feeling about the nature of who I am as a being. And so I learned that my physical body is not my real self. I just inhabit it for a time in order to learn certain things, often traumatic and hard things to learn. But That's all part of it. So what we're seeking to do is to refine ourselves and to become in touch with that divine spark inside us. When I had people talk about this in the past, I was always mystified about, you know, people saying we are really divine beings. But understanding how the goddess works makes it more feasible and sensible and logical that we're created from the essence of the goddess, so we have that essence inside us. So that's why I follow a goddess path rather than the typical male divinity path of, you know, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, the classic world religions. Makes a lot more sense to me that the divinity that creates the physical world in all its aspects is feminine divinity, not masculine one.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I know this is on the back of the mind of a lot of people who are listening. It's always right behind the scenes a lot of times for me when I talk to people who are deep into magic or Wicca or any of those things, and that's it. I'm not a Christian, but I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a religious person. But if a Christian comes to me and says, hey, you know what? It's all about love. It's all about selfless service. I get that.
Nothing wrong with that.
Right. But here's the thing. I mean, I may think that their knowledge of history is pretty lame, and they're not, and I probably push them on the historicity of Jesus, and I may think they're kind of close-minded about how their sacred texts have been twisted by the institutions and control and manipulation. But what they're saying speaks to my heart, versus if I speak to someone and they practice magic, and the first thing they want to tell me is about Aleister Crowley and do what thou wilt. I mean, I don't get it, you know, and then we can spin it around and tell, you know, all this other stuff. But it's like, I don't get that. Love, selfless service speaks to my heart. Do what thou wilt. I can't get there. It comes back and it starts sounding a lot like power, control,
self-indulgence. I do talk about that in the book, about Crowley's approach to things. I go into quite a lot of detail about that. But, yeah, I mean, love is at the basis of spiritual reality. So I think, you know, people who focus on that, good on them, that's fine. But, you know, Kuhn says that the whole Jesus story, the whole basis of Christianity, is actually taken from the Egyptian texts, and that in Egypt and Greece, that the mystery plays and the mystery tradition were all about understanding that coming into the physical world is coming into really like death. What we think about of death as death is not how those people saw it. The physical world is death, and the spiritual world is life. So it's completely...
But does that matter? I don't think that matters. I mean, from my vantage point, the fact that millions and millions of people connect with Christ consciousness on a way that deeply affects their life and causes spiritual transformation for them, that's the evidence that I care about more than I care about some wanky history of, you know, the historical Jesus and all that. And that's what I think people struggle with. And that's what I think Christianity, you know, the real deeper spiritual Christianity is so misunderstood. They're just going, well, what they're saying without even realizing it is that it's all about Christ consciousness and Christ consciousness is real. And I, from my experience with these people, I have no way to dispute that. Yes, Christ consciousness seems to be very real in these people's lives in a way that we would all look at and point to and say, well, that seems to be spirituality in its purest form.
Well, I would not agree that there was a historical Jesus or a historical Christ. I think that this is all the mystery tradition stolen from the Egyptians and
Well, what does that matter? I'm saying why does that obviously matter?
What is Christ consciousness?
The easiest way to describe it again is through the accounts of people who have a near-death experience, because when we, the nice thing about the near-death experience is we can really kind of put some alligator clips on the experiment here, and we can say,
and they all say, they all say they met Jesus at the end of the tunnel. Is that the story?
No, they don't all say, but enough of them say, enough of them say that for us to then say, we have to start looking seriously at the reality of that Christ consciousness. And I just don't see how we can then, like you did, you know, marry that back and say, oh yeah, but we've already looked at history books. You know, Jesus Christ, the way he's written in the book of Mark, didn't exist. Yeah, we all know he didn't. That isn't true. But we don't understand how this Christ consciousness figure seems to work for all these people.
Well, I would suggest that what they're actually coming in contact with is their own soul.
Well, you could say that about anything. You could say that about all your practices, all the practice, all the experiences that you've had. We could say that about Josephine in the earlier story. We could say that about every story in your book.
Why would you say that?
Well, we could. I mean, because that's what the Buddhist would say, right? The Buddhist would say, you know, the drop of water in the ocean, and you can look at all little droplets and kind of make up all sorts of stories about what they're really doing and how they're interacting. But it's really just one ocean of consciousness, right?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. Do you mean the mind of divinity? Is that what you're talking about? We all exist in the mind of divinity?
I'm saying if you overlay some kind of hierarchy of, you know, that behind it is a higher and higher soul, or a higher, higher coming together of the consciousness, well, then we don't really have anything left to talk about. Then we're just saying, well, it's all a creation underneath that higher hierarchical structure, right? Because when I pushed you and said, well, you know, this Christ consciousness thing, and you said it's all just a reflection of their soul, right?
Well, I'd say, you know, people who see Jesus, in inverted commas, standing at the end of the tunnel, you know, in light, are actually experiencing an encounter with their own soul, not Jesus, because Jesus, in my view, doesn't actually exist. But the soul certainly exists, and a lot of the attributions of the soul are exactly what people would attribute to Christ consciousness, you know, a loving but impersonal, loving kind of radiance, and that's also an attribute of the goddess. So I do talk about Aparantos in the book.
Returning to the book and to your practice, because I want people to really understand that one of the things I think is awesome about what you do, you seem to be very committed to being a people helper.
Oh, well, I'll take the physical approach first. If a person presents with what I consider to be physical problems, I'll treat that, you know, probably with herbal medicine or vitamins and minerals, or change their diet. I'm trained as a naturopath, so, you know, I'll go to those remedies first. And then if the person isn't getting a result, we'll look at doing something else, some psychotherapy practice, or, and then, I don't know whether this is a good idea or not, it's just how I work. And then go to looking at spiritual causes. And spiritual causes are more common than you would imagine. And probably at the heart of all illness is a spiritual cause. That's the way a shaman would look at it, that even physical illness has a basically a spiritual core to it. So it might be, you know, in past lives they've done things that require readjustment, like harming animals or children is a very big no-no spiritually. So if a person's been involved in doing something like that, they might be suffering a physical illness. They might have to do something to redress the problem. I had a client who you just have to keep an open mind about this, who in a past life had killed a baby in a ritual sacrifice, and in this life had really terrible symptoms of going insane. And so when I worked with her in a spiritual sense, we discovered what the cause of her massively bad headaches were and other physical symptoms that she had. And so when we treated the cause, then the physical symptoms disappeared. So, yeah, I mean, some people are just happy to take a homeopathic medicine and get rid of the symptoms. In other cases, you need to look deeper and to discover if there is a spiritual problem that needs to be solved in some way. And spirit possession is actually more common than most people would realize. It's quite a common cause of illness. So we'd look at persuading the attaching entity to move on into the non-physical world, to leave the physical world where they've become what's called earthbound, and to move on into the other reality, the spiritual reality. And the big problem with all of this is we don't have narratives in the West to describe that process very effectively. And so a lot of people who pass over, a lot of people who live the physical body, are hanging around very confused and uncertain about what they should do and how they should act. And so out of fear, they attach to someone, often a family member, and that creates a raft of very bad symptoms for that person usually. And a sense of, you know, being divided. I think that case I just talked about, the person in that case had this sense of being two people and unable to draw them together. And it turned out that she had, this is very convoluted, but a partner, a husband from a previous reality, when that baby had been sacrificed, and he had attached to her lifetime after lifetime in order to bring her to justice, in order to come to realize that she'd done something wrong and she needed to redress the balance. So in that sense, it's all about redressing balance rather than somebody being terribly naughty and having a spirit attached to them because of that. It's all about restoring the balance.
Fascinating stuff. So, Dr. Kent, are these the kind of issues that people seek your help for, and how do they go about doing that?
Well, they usually come because they're sick. They don't understand they've got a spiritual attachment. You know, like voices in the head and all of that kind of stuff, schizophrenic symptoms, I would suggest possibly are because of spirit attachments. And like I say, it's more common than people realize, but people don't come for that. They often come because they're feeling depressed or anxious, or they have some physical symptoms they'd like to get rid of because they're uncomfortable or very painful or whatever. So it's just as we work that, you know, it starts to become apparent as the layers get peeled away that at the basis of this there is a spiritual problem. So even things like a broken leg, you know, can have a spiritual resonance because, you know, it's stopping the person going in the direction they were going and making them reevaluate and think about their life and what they're doing and how it's going. So that even a broken leg has a spiritual purpose, if you understand what I mean.
Tell folks how they can, first of all, the Goddess and the Shaman, it's on Amazon, yes?
It's on all the sites, Booko, Book Depository, Amazon. It's published in America, so it should be in all the bookshops.
And it's from Llewellyn, which is a major publisher of these kind of books, so we can find it there too. And how can people find you? Website?
I'm setting up a website, but if they want to address any questions or write to me, they can write through Llewellyn's, and Llewellyn's will send any mail on to me.
Great. Well, it's been awesome having you on. Again, our guest has been Dr. Jane Kent. The book that you're going to want to check out is The Goddess and the Shaman. Jane, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for the hardball.
Oh, you got it. You got plenty of it, didn't you?
I did. But it's okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Dr. Jane Kent for joining me today on Skeptico. I have to mention, as I did in the show, that Jane's partner, Mike Patterson, is somebody who I've had a nice email exchange with over the last couple of years, a quite extensive email exchange. And Mike's even written a post or two for Skeptico, and we're doing a really interesting interview together, an email interview with a rather well-known channeler who has written some books on that. And I think it's going to explore some of these topics in another way that I find very interesting, because I find channeled information both fascinating and challenging at the same time. So I want to not only preview that interview that's coming up, but also thank Mike for connecting me with his partner, Jane, and I hope I wasn't too hard on her. But as you listeners have kind of nudged me in this direction, I think it's a good one. And that's that, you know, if I'm going to be tough on people and ask the hard questions, then I have to do it evenly and fairly to both people who I generally agree with, as well as people I don't so much agree with. And for me, it's not hard. I'll tell you, it's not hard to find points of disagreement, as you can see in this interview. So let me tee up one question from this interview, and it has to do with the issue of Christ consciousness. And Jane and I kind of took opposite sides of this issue, and that is, do you think Christ consciousness could be a reality, air quotes in reality, in this extended consciousness realm? Or does the questionable archaeology, historical records of a single solitary Jesus figure as portrayed in the Bible, does that make that Christ consciousness idea kind of a non-starter? I don't know if I phrased that quite correctly, but I think you get the idea. Jane was taking the position that, hey, I don't believe Jesus existed, therefore I can't accept any ideal like Christ consciousness. And I was taking the position that, you know, it doesn't matter as much about the exact history of this person who's identified as Jesus. Jesus Christ consciousness figure seems to show up, and we have to use that as a starting point. So it's something to pull apart. I'd love to get your ideas on that, either directly to me through an email or that voicemail message. The number is on the website, or of course through the forum or through Facebook, all at skeptiko.com, SKEPTIKO, where you can also download the show for free, over 300 episodes, subscribe to the show, write a review of the show, although it's an impossible uphill battle because the show has been so overwhelmed with skeptical haters. I have an unbelievable number of hate reviews on iTunes. But if you would like to try and reverse that trend a little bit, I would love to have you write a review. But in general, what I encourage anyone to do who likes the show is share the show with someone else who you think would enjoy it. I love to introduce the show to new people and get fresh ideas and fresh perspectives from folks who haven't heard it before. So that's always fun for me. Well, I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I don't know if all of them will be right up your alley. As you know, I pretty much follow my own path, and that sometimes takes a departure from where one group or another group is going, but hey, that's the fun of the show as well. If you don't like one episode, stick around. Maybe you'll like the next one. So all of that's coming up in the future. Until next time, do take care, and bye for now.